I also put some business cards out there, so call me, text me, email me, whatever you want to know, I'll answer. So, I'm just curious, how many of you out there have challenges of some kind? If you didn't raise your hand, you probably have more challenges than all the rest of us. Of course everyone has challenges. Challenges are universal. Does this sound familiar? Roll out of bed at 5 a.m. with a heart full of anxiety and stress. Take a quick shower. Toss on some clothes that you're not sure of. Your husband's too busy to care. He has his own things going on. Your head is on fire with all the tasks that kept you up half the night. Perhaps you have kids you have to get up for school. You gotta feed the dogs. They're important. Pull something from the freezer for dinner. Make a plan to pick up kids after soccer practice. Print that file you need for a client before you even start your day. I don't drink coffee, but I certainly understand the need for it. My morning starts with Facebook. Emails and text messages vie for just a few seconds, and before I know it, an hour and a half is gone. My phone is relentless. A client wants me to Google the print shop nearest him in Oskaloosa, Iowa, and email a file there for him to print. Most of my clients today are Amish. They don't do email, they don't do text, they don't do the internet. All the things that make business so easy, they don't do, and I do for them. Time is a challenge. This is an important thing. You can write this down. Time has only one master, and that's priority. We have no control over time, but we have all the control in the world over priority. Some of you might be sitting there thinking, I wish I could sleep till 5 a.m., or I wish I could own my own business. We all have challenges and see grass is greener on the other side, but it never is. There's an old saying, a woman's character is measured by the size of the challenge that stops her. I think that's really important, so I'm going to say it again. A woman's character is measured by the size of the challenge that stops her. How do you respond to challenges? I've learned to double down. I have another question. Who here has been 5 years old? Can you remember being five? It comes right after four. Five is a really important year. 90% of our brain development is complete by the age of five. We learn a lot by the time we turn five. We've learned how to walk. We've learned how to talk. We've learned how to feed ourselves. We've even learned how to pick out clothes, mostly to our parents' dismay. But these natural milestones give us a foundation for the emergence of our basic personalities. When we're five, the toddler fog begins to lift. We become self-aware. We begin building the memories of a lifetime. We start school. Wow, that was my favorite thing. If I could just figure out a way to make a living by going to school, I'd have it made. At five, we discover ourselves and our self-esteem. We become fixed in our attitude about the world. It turns out, I've been five almost my entire life. Imagine being 5 years old. Waiting. Mom's in the kitchen fixing lunch. At five, waiting is hard. Patience was never my strong suit, but for a five-year-old, waiting is not easy. At five, we haven't even wrapped our heads around time. To a five-year-old, a moment is as much as a century or a second. There's no difference. Waiting? Waiting for what? Waiting for cartoons on TV, waiting for dinner, waiting for your little brother in the bathroom. What are we waiting for? I thought I was waiting for life to begin, and I thought it began when the school bus arrived. My dad was handsome and fun, and he loved me. He was the center of my world. When I heard him clawing his way up the basement stairs, that morning, I knew something was wrong. My mom stepped out of the kitchen, and the look on her face just confirmed to me that something serious had happened. Her mouth dropped, and she stared at my dad. She dropped the dish towel in her hand. And my dad, he stood at the top of the stairs with his arms out like this, because he was so badly burned that he couldn't put them against his body. His ears were gone. I could see little nubs, but there were no more ears. And his hair was smoking. His whole body was wet, but I knew it wasn't from water. I just didn't understand what it was from. And his skin was black, and it was rolling down his arms. It looked just like when my mom took her pantyhose off. But my dad didn't have pantyhose on his arms. My dad blinked his eyes and said, "Peg, I'm so sorry. I knew better." Emotions painted a memory in my head so precise that I can relive that moment every day of my life. I didn't have the depth to understand the gravity of that moment. But today, more than 50 years later, 50 years of faith and hard work have flowed under the bridge. I see now that Dad didn't mean that he was sorry that he had burned himself or that he was in excruciating pain. He wasn't apologizing for messing up that day's schedule. He wasn't feeling sorry for himself. He was already regretting the many years of pain that this event would bring on all of us for the rest of our lives. Somehow, he knew that we would all carry scars from his burns. If, at 5 years old, you were the first witness to your daddy's horrific burns, wouldn't you feel it was your duty to be a big girl? I did. I felt compelled to change diapers, make lunches, fold clothes, and do everything in my power to fill that gap, because my dad was gone to the hospital, and my mom was gone with him. At 5 years old, I believed I had the power to make a difference. What I didn't know was that I was too young to take on that kind of responsibility. I did what I must, but it cost me dearly. Something fractured inside. I grew up normally with family Christmases, first days at school, trick-or-treating, and graduations. But someplace deep inside, that five-year-old girl had power. She was so busy doing chores and performing her duties that she forgot to grow up. I had no conscious awareness of this little girl, but when I needed her, she took the reins. Let's take a moment and review what it's like to be 5 years old. First of all, five-year-olds are immature, but that's part of what we love about them. They're filled with hope and belief, and the depth of their belief is enviable. Five-year-olds believe in unicorns and tooth fairies and the assuredness of tomorrows. When a five-year-old walks into the room, adults naturally create a pocket of protectiveness around her. They listen to her stories and smile at her delight. We don't genuinely respect five-year-olds, but we forgive them over and over and over again because they're only 5 years old. Their innocence provides them with a free pass to just run through social barriers, literally and figuratively. Don't we all secretly wish we could be 5 years old again when our world was innocent and pure? Five-year-olds are desperate for attention and love, and that was my flaw. The five-year-old that strapped on her boots was a taskmaster. I was driven by duty to make perfect grades at school, to never be late for curfew, to never be late for a meeting, to always do whatever it took to make my parents proud. My five-year-old psyche didn't get to move past being a five-year-old girl. She got stuck, and that's not normal. Everyone else leaves their five-year-old behind when they turn 6 or 12 or 21. I was introduced to duty when I should have been chasing unicorns. Damn it, I missed my whole childhood. I still miss it. By the time my dad came home from the hospital, I had been on duty for 9 months. 9 months to a 5-year-old is the better part of their conscious life. Duty was now a habit, not an exception. We all have our flaws. It's how we deal with them that defines who and what we are. I ignored the little girl who always wanted attention, the 5-year-old that was never satisfied. She was a flaw with power and influence over me. 40 years of duty and obedience got me a job making $120,000 a year. We had cars and a house and horses and toys. We wanted for nothing. Except I still had a need I couldn't identify. Cancer and layoffs and desperation left me alive, but full of questions. That's when an opportunity appeared. I was desperate to make a difference, to do something that would make a difference in the world. And I was presented an opportunity to start a prison dog program at Lansing Correctional Facility. I was given that offer on a Monday. On Wednesday, I was giving a PowerPoint presentation to the warden and the entire executive board. And on Friday, I was driving all around Kansas City picking up dogs so I could fill a prison dog program at the prison. And that's kind of how I do things. You know, you better watch out if you're getting on Toby's train because it'll blow you right over. So. Safe Harbor was maybe, I hope though not, the most awesome thing I ever did. I hope that there's better yet to come. But I was really making a difference in the lives of those dogs. And I knew that I could do that. In 18 months, I saved 1,000 dogs. Wow. 1,000 dogs that were all going to be put to sleep if I didn't take them. That was making a difference. But what I didn't expect was the difference it made in the lives of the inmates. You know, being in prison is a totally unnatural thing for a human being. It's not safe to have a relationship with anyone. It's not safe to trust anyone. You don't get to hug anyone. I mean, could you imagine going 10 years without ever hugging someone? I think I'd die. Most of them did. They died inside. But when I brought those dogs into the prison, all of a sudden, every inmate in that prison was free to hug a dog, walk a dog, have a dog sleep with them in their bed, kiss a dog, tell the dog their worst nightmares. I wasn't prepared for the difference it made in the men inside that prison, but it was even more profound than the difference it made in the dog's life. And it was that 5-year-old who burst into color when a handsome inmate noticed. I was married. I had a life outside prison. He was doing life. He was a convicted murderer. I was summa cum laude. He had a rap sheet. A little flirtation wasn't dangerous. After all, he was in prison. I could leave anytime I wanted. It seemed harmless. There were a lot of social boundaries we could never cross. But the 5-year-old in me, social boundaries were her specialty, and she danced all around them. The little girl in me did all the heavy lifting, but when John Maynard noticed me, that 5-year-old took control, and I was powerless. He loved the color of my eyes and how they matched my hair. He loved the way I smelled. My husband didn't even know that I wore perfume. Life had worn me out, and I was exhausted. I was a dying plant, and John was a cool drink of water. John stood up for me. He loved me and protected me from the darker spirits of the prison. John asked me about my husband, and for the first time, my inner child asked me, "Yeah, what about your husband?" And seeds were planted. So listen carefully. My story is indiscretion, fear, desire, envy, adolescent humor, and a long list of other derogatory elements. But that's just the beginning, because it is also tenacity, strength, grit, forgiveness, redemption, and love. Write this down. Gold is tested in fire, and acceptable women in the furnace of humiliation. Do you like metaphors? I love metaphors. Here's one I thought of. I created a magnificent cloak. It was adorned with purple velvet and tasseled ties. It was heavy and dark and warm. It concealed me and let me be invisible. You may have a cloak too. Mine had words embossed across the back that told the world I was on duty. I felt and behaved like a superhero. But the fact is, I'm only human. And that cloak was an evil burden, a cloak of perfection. It had to go. You can keep your cloak if you wish, but I cast mine aside. In the end, I betrayed the trust of the prison system, the trust of my family. John Maynard put himself in a box inside of a dog crate and had the crate placed into my prison van. I drove away through the gates of the prison. Part of me wanted to hear sirens and wanted to hear the officers holler for a lockdown. But the other part was filled with hope for a different life. Being the law-abiding citizen I was, I bought a truck for the escape, and I had the registration sent to our hideout in Tennessee. Because you can't drive without a license. That's how they tracked us down and caught us. I've had people ask if I did that on purpose. I didn't think I did, but the more I think about it, I'm not so sure. I think it might have been some breadcrumbs I left behind. The night of the arrest, the night of the car chase, the infamous night, we were driving down an interstate about 10:30 at night. John and I were wearing these ridiculous wigs that we thought would make us not look like who we were. That was a dumb idea. We stopped at a bookstore in a parking lot in Chattanooga, and we walked right in front of the U.S. Marshals, who were sitting in a car wondering where we might be, because they'd already been to our cabin that day and we weren't there. We walked right in front of their truck. Those wigs didn't fool them a bit. They knew exactly who we were. So they pulled on the highway behind us and followed us and set up this trap up ahead on the highway. It was the craziest thing. We were just driving along, and all of a sudden, there was a helicopter above us shining a light on us, and we looked out onto the highway, and there was 100 police cars, maybe more. But there were SWAT cars, and there was FBI cars, and there was marshal cars, and there was sheriff's cars, and there was black and white city cars, and there was county police. There was every known vehicle known to man, every color of car out there, but they all had lights on. Of course, they wanted us to pull over. And John asked me, "What do you want to do, Toby?" And I said, "Well, if they ask you to pull over, you have to pull over because that's the law." And he said, "If that's what you want to do, that's what we'll do." And just as he was getting ready to pull over, one of those cars sped around us and whipped in front of us and slammed on their brakes. And John was not happy. He said, "Those MFs are trying to kill us. I'm going to run until we run out of gas. I'm not pulling over." And I looked over at the gas tank and it said 3/4 of a tank. And I thought, that's a long time before we'll run out of gas. I can't do it this long. We sped down the highway, and this was an interstate in Tennessee. I don't even know which one. And it was a kind of highway where the northbound lanes and the southbound lanes were separated by about a half a mile of forest in between them. So you couldn't see the right lanes from the left lanes. So when the police cars got really heavy and thick on the northbound lanes. John drove through the trees at 100 miles an hour, and we came out into the southbound lanes. The funny thing is that the entire time we were in that car chase, I could not hear one sound. And everything was in slow motion. It seemed like it was taking us forever. But I know that wasn't the case, but somehow that's how my brain was protecting me. I knew when we went off the road, onto the shoulder, and then the semi truck tried to force us off, and we went off into the grass. And when we came back up off the grass, the wheels caught the highway, and we were going 100 miles an hour. And when the wheels caught that highway, they locked up, and we didn't have any control over the truck. We sped straight across the highway, right in front of that semi-truck that tried to push us off the road. And we're heading right for this forest of trees. And I knew exactly which tree we were going to hit. I don't know how, but we just went straight for it. And I remember praying to God to please, please let me die in this wreck, because I can't deal with this. Thank God he didn't. Because I've learned that life can be pretty good. But I didn't simply cast aside that cloak of perfection. It was tattered and shredded in such a way that I could never wear it again. They took me back in shackles. I was charged with aiding and abetting, providing contraband, aggravated prison escape. I don't know what it was. Chris asked me 2 days ago, what were your charges? And I said, I don't know. He said, how can you not know? And I said, because I didn't care. It didn't matter to me. I just knew what I'd done, and I knew what time I had to serve, and it didn't matter what they called it. But I spent 27 months, some of it in state prison, but most of it in federal prison. The strange thing is that it was there where I found relief from my lifelong obsession with duty. Somehow, inside those prison walls, I began to discover who I was. I found freedom in the strangest of places, behind bars. All my energy was turned to me. I laid down the burdens I'd been carrying my entire life. I spent time figuring out who I was. I had cold, hard days, but the soil I found for a garden was rich and deep. I'm a better person today because of that journey. Some people ask me, do you wish that out of your life? And I can't wish it away, because I think going to prison was the best thing that ever happened to me, except for maybe meeting my husband. But unbelievable growth can happen when you're at the lowest you can possibly be, because there's nowhere for you to go but up. It's been 12 years. 12 years of hard work. The 12 days of our escape was a turning point for me. I had no idea where God was leading me, but any place was better than prison, the kind with the bars or the kind without. I don't recommend taking my approach to unplugging from a failed marriage or an unfulfilling life. It's one way of doing it. It was the only way I knew. But I came here today for two women. These women are polar opposites, not so much in terms of beliefs or philosophies, but in terms of where they are in the time continuum. I am uniquely qualified to speak to each of them. First, women out there who have already taken a bite of that apple. I'm here to speak to all of you who have fallen in love with convicted murderers and helped them escape. Do we have any of those in the room? Well, be careful. That can happen. You don't have to commit a felony and go to prison to face serious adversity. A divorce, a death, a failed business, broken homes, and broken relationships. all have the power to drop the strongest woman to her knees. If you are a woman that has fallen and stubbed your toe, I know the pain you feel. You are not alone. I know what you've done and what drove you to it. I know how difficult it is to come back from being down. But know this, God can do anything. Education opens doors, and victory is the sweetest when the challenges are the greatest. The other women I came here for is under a lot of stress. Is that you? Are you under a lot of stress? I must tell you, don't do it. It'll seem innocent enough until it's not. Stop at the bar and drink one or two or seven. The end of that road is an unhappy one. That cute guy at work that flirts with you, don't do him. I mean, it. Don't do it. Are your priorities a little off kilter? Perhaps a simple fix is to drive a little faster. Don't do it. Don't break John Maynard out of prison. Face your fears. Boldly evaluate where you are and do something about it. I have been rejected by my community, and today I am still rejected by many members of my family. They put conditions on our relationship, and talking to you today violates one of those conditions. But I came here today because my heart is in this. I am here for you. I want to make a difference in your life. I want to be an inspiration. God has commissioned me to share my story, and I pray that it inspires you. By the way, do you know the difference between inspiration and motivation? Motivation pushes. Inspiration pulls. Incidentally, being pushed requires someone to be behind you. Motivation can come from anyone with authority, but pulling must have someone in front of you. Inspiration needs a leader. When trouble came knocking, I doubled down. I won't try to tell anyone how easy it was. It was not. But today, I have two master's degrees and a lucrative web design and internet marketing business. Surprisingly, my Amish clients all know my story, and they welcome me into their midst with open arms. I am married to a wonderful guy that loves me and knows that relationships are about understanding, empathy, forgiveness, and second chances. I'm here to remind you, you are enough. Dorothy always had the power to go home. She just never believed it. Find the strength of character to explore who you really are. Have the courage to cast off your cloak and fulfill your potential. I am a storyteller and a writer, but more importantly, I am a survivor, an explorer, a risk taker, and a butterfly. Your time as a caterpillar has expired. Your wings are ready. Go write your stories. Children. So we had a five-year-old, a four-year-old, three-year-old, two-year-old, and a nine-month-old. I personally believe that the five oldest of us kids all show damage from that period in our lives. We just show it in different ways. My two youngest brothers and sisters were born after my dad was home and healed, and their life was totally different than ours. Was I ever afraid when I was with John Maynard? Not really. There were times when I realized that I'd done something really stupid and I didn't really have any outs. I mean, John, there was only one key to the truck and John had it. There was only one key to the cabin and John had it. I brought a bunch of cash with us and John had it. So I felt trapped. But, and there were times when he got angry about stuff and... But I didn't really feel like he was going to hurt me.
And Toby, you loved him.
I loved him. Yes, I did. And it took me a good 3 years to get over loving him. And I finally had to realize that I can't move forward until I let go of this, because there can be no future in this. So it was tough. It was really tough for me, but I did love him.
Can you talk about the women you met in prison and then the women who wrote you in prison?
Yes. When I was in prison, I got a lot of letters from women I'd never met who said, "Oh my God, that could have been me. I can see how you did that. I can see myself doing that." And that kind of opened my eyes a little bit, because it made me feel not quite so stupid. Because, you know, it's pretty embarrassing to have everything pulled out on the news and in the paper, and nothing was sacred. And it was really embarrassing, especially for a perfectionist, a lifelong perfectionist, to have every single thing put out there for the whole world to see. The women I met in prison, gosh, I loved them all. I mean, I met some wonderful women in prison, but they all needed help. When I was in the county jail, most of the women I was in prison with, or in jail with at the time, could not read a cursive letter. And they couldn't read a printed letter if it had more than 5 characters in a word. So I spent a lot of time reading mail to these women and helping them write letters to their families. The funny thing is, my first roommate in jail, the warden at the Leavenworth County Jail, the administrator, he was nervous about putting me in general population because I was high profile and he didn't want the media to get hold of if I got hurt in prison. Oh my gosh, that would look bad for him. So he told me he was going to put me in SEG, which is you're locked in a room all by yourself all day long. And I said, I am not going to SEG. Why do you want to put me there? And he said, Toby, you don't know what these women are like. You're going to have a candy bar, and they're going to beat you up for it. And I said, well, I'll just share with them then. So he put me in general population, but only after I signed a paper that said I was relinquishing all my rights to safety and security, and they couldn't be held liable and all this stuff. So they take me into the women's pod. And when I walked through the door, I'd been there for 3 weeks already in the jail, but they kept me in this medical holding cell up front because they were just sure I was going to bomb out. But I didn't, because the media was out there waiting. And I decided it wasn't a good place to be, so I'd just stay right there. And so after 3 weeks, they took me into general population. And when I walked through the door, the women all said, we wondered when they were going to get you down here. And I think the officer said, who has an empty bed? And Jennifer spoke up. She said, I've got a bed. Put her up in my room. So we go up to Jennifer's room, and Jennifer weighs about 350 pounds. And we get locked in the room together for the first count, and Jennifer says to me, do you hear voices? I said, no. She said, I do. I hear voices. I try really hard to fight those voices, but I just can't make them stop. These voices tell me to do these terrible things. They tell me to hurt people. And I try hard to fight them and not do it, but these voices just get louder and louder and louder, and I can't stop them. And she said, and I cut myself, see? And she held up her arms, and she had all these cuts on her arms. And she said, I don't know why I cut myself, but I feel better when I cut myself. I think it lets the voices out when I cut myself. And then she said, those voices tell me to do terrible things to people. But I don't think I'll hurt you. I think I like you. You want to play cards? And I said, absolutely, I'll play cards. I'll play cards all night. So poor Jennifer. I just loved her. She was only 18. And she truly had some mental problems. But when they put her in jail, they took away, they do this. When they put you in jail or they move you to a prison or from one prison to another, they take away all your medications. And they won't give you any until you go through the doctors at the new place and they decide they think you need them. Well, Jennifer had been in the county jail for 2 months with no meds. And she seriously needed them. And so I got my thyroid pill every day because my family out there had an attorney who said, went to the judge and said, Toby will have her thyroid pill every day. And so when the nurse came in the mornings for pill call, they called out the names for people who had pills on the cart. And every day Jennifer said, do you have anything for me? And they said, they'd say no. And so this one day Jennifer just got so mad and she started pounding on the concrete wall of her cell, and she busted her hands open, and they were bruised and bleeding, and she just kept beating on the wall, and she pushed the button on the intercom so the people in the control booth could hear everything. And I know that administrator was thinking, holy crap, we got Toby Young in there with her. We've got to get her out. So here comes the SWAT team, and they come in, and they turn Jennifer around and they tell her to put her hands behind her back because they're going to cuff her and take her to SAG. And I said, I can't believe I did, but I stood up and I said, listen, Jennifer does not need to be taken to SAG. She needs some ice packs for her hands. Look at her hands. Go get her some ice packs and I'll calm her down. And they said, okay. And they laughed. So later that day, the administrator did come down and move me out of Jennifer's room. And Jennifer just cried and cried and cried because she said, I don't want to not have a roommate. I want to be your roommate. But anyway, then a day later, they came and picked her up and took her to Osawatomie, where she spent 6 weeks. And she did come back, and she did have her medications, and she was better. But there's all kinds of stories like that of people who just... you have no power, and you just fall through the cracks, and people just don't treat you like a human being when you're in jail or when you're in prison, and it's just really sad. So, yes?
You said that you found freedom behind bars, and you took off your cloak of duties. Was there an aha moment, or was it a gradual process, or do you have anything more to share about?
There was two aha moments. The first one was the very first Saturday that I was in jail, and I woke up on Saturday morning and I said, it's Saturday, it's dog adoption day, and I don't have to go. And that was just a turn on a light for me, because that was the first duty I was shed of. And then later, when I went to the state prison, and I realized I had all this time on my hands, and I could spend this time either complaining or, you know, pointing out how I was a victim or not taking responsibility for what I did, or I could use that time to really start to learn who I was. And then I started thinking, you know, there's all these really rich actors in Hollywood who pay a lot of money to go to these Spartan spas where they can find themselves. And here I am. So that's what I'm going to do. So those were my two aha moments. Yes?
So, I mean, what is a day, not in too much detail, but a day in the life of a prisoner? I mean, I don't want to say is there therapy, but do you have any group?
There is no therapy. There is no group sessions. There is no Bible studies. Here's the thing I learned. I was a volunteer in the men's prison for 18 months. The men had cable TV. They had programs. They had jobs. They had everything. It was like a city. The women's prison does not have cable TV. It does not have Bible study. You can go to the library once a week. You can go outside for 1 hour a day. And I figured out it was because the women couldn't organize enough to stand up for themselves. I mean, the most important job in the men's prison was the guy who ran the cable TV. He was on call 24/7 because if cable TV went out, there was going to be a riot. The women didn't even get cable TV because they couldn't stand up and go ask for it, because then they start going, you looked at her and I pulled my hair and you took a coffee and, you know, it's like, breathe. Women, organize. So it was kind of funny because in the county jail, there's this thing called a kite. And when you send a kite in jail or prison, the administration must answer. Even if it's just like no, but they must answer. They're bound by rule to answer. So in the county jail, they had ramen noodles on the commissary, and they had potato chips, and that's about it. And so I said, why can't we have peanut butter? I mean, one thing about being in jail or prison is you are chronically always hungry. There's never enough food. And the food that they give you is not satisfying. It's just a bunch of empty calories. So people depend on what's on the commissary. So I said, we're going to get some good food on this commissary. And the women said, how are we going to do that? And I said, every one of you, go get a kite form and sit down right here and copy exactly what I'm writing. So every day, every one of us turned in a kite that said, we want peanut butter, we want chapstick, we want shampoo, we want, you know, these certain things that are just not that, you know, we were buying them. So why couldn't we have them if we were going to pay for them? And the jail administrator came down one day and he said, Miss Young, you are killing me. Stop these kites. What's it going to take? And I said, peanut butter. And so 2 days later, he came in with a box of stuff, and he said, okay, here's all the things I'm considering putting on the commissary. And what I want you to do is I want you guys to taste them all and tell me if you'd buy them. And so the women said, I get this, I get that. And one woman said, no. Toby was responsible for this. She's going to decide who gets what. And I said, well, here's how we're going to do it. Everybody go get your spoon, because we're all going to have a bite of everything. And so we got better food on the commissary. A typical day in prison is like this. You get up for count at 6 or 7 in the morning, and then you are locked in your cell for 2 hours while they count everybody in the whole facility. And then you get to get out for breakfast. And then you get locked back in your room, and then you get to get out for lunch, and then you might be out in the day room for an hour or two where you can watch TV. And then it's dinner time, and then you can take a shower. Now, when I was in the facility I was in the longest, there were 6 showers, and there was 80 women. There were no doors for the shower. This was like our day room, and this was our TV, and the showers were right along the wall over there, and there were no curtains. There was nothing. You just took your shower out in the middle of the room where the officers could see you, the women could see you. There was no privacy. So there were 6 showers. We went through this routine every night where you reserved the shower you wanted by putting your towel there and in an order. Now, we all had little white towels that were about this big. So I don't know how anybody knew which towel was theirs, but they did. And everybody tried real hard to not get in the shower on the far right, because after the 3rd shower, these gray and black worms crawled up out of the drain. And you had to take your shower with those worms in your shower with you. So, and after your shower, you went to bed. And the next day you got up and you did the very same thing all over again. Yes.
So, 2 questions. 1, what happened to John Maynard? And second question is, do you have a relationship with your children?
Okay, those are good questions. John Maynard, he was already doing a life sentence, and when he got paroled from his life sentence, then he had to do 117 months. So, after the escape, he got 20 more years added to his sentence. So, unfortunately, I don't think he'll ever get out of prison. I don't think he'll ever get paroled from his life sentence, let alone be able to serve those other 30 years that he's got on there now. I do not have a relationship with my children. I had two sons at the time of the escape, and they were 25 and 21. And the day I got out of prison, my youngest son was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he died a year later.
I'm sorry.
So that was tough. That was really tough. But I never did get to have to reconcile with him before he died. I did go see him, and I told him that I'd always loved him, and he said he knew that. And I asked if I could give him a hug, and he said no. And so, but since he's passed, I've had a dream where he told me he loved me. So, you know, I think it's all good. My oldest son has three children now, and I'm not even sure where he lives, somewhere in the Kansas City area, but he does not choose to have a relationship with me. So I give him his space, and someday, I used to think with enough time that it would heal and we could have a relationship, but it's been 12 years. So I think probably it's going to take too much effort to make a change now. So I think that's kind of just the norm. So, no, I don't.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thanks. A question over there?
Yes.
Have you gone back into the prisons to with women to do any speaking?
I have not gone back into the women's prison. I would love to. I don't know if they'd let me back. Because when you help someone escape, you're kind of not very welcome. Although I would love to go back. And the funny thing is that when I was in prison, I was always in max custody because they'd say, you're an escape risk. And it's like, if you drew a line in the sand, I would never cross it. But they didn't believe me. So, but we have done some mentoring of people when they've gotten out of prison. And I think that that's probably a better fit for me. So,
I want to ask one thing.
Yes.
We've got to wrap it up.
You did go back and visit
yes.
John with your husband. So I would like you to address that. And then before we let you go, thank you for being here, would you tell us as a group, we are a charitable organization, if there was something we could do for those women, what would it be? Is it write letters?
Okay, that's a great question. John Maynard, the state of Kansas doesn't want to mess with John Maynard because they view him as a thorn in their side. So there's a system where you can trade prisoners. You know, one state has somebody they don't like, and they'll take your guy that you don't like, and they just kind of trade that way. So, yeah, it's a prison swap. So John Maynard got sent to New Hampshire. He was actually in prison in New Hampshire. He was in Berlin, and then he got transferred down to Concord. And Chris, my husband, is from Maine. And so we were driving back to Maine to go visit, and, oh, I should back up. Somebody who was a reporter gave John Maynard my phone number about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and he called me. And so we started talking on the phone, and he talked to Chris quite a bit, too. And John said, I'm going to send you a visiting form. I said, you've got to be crazy. They aren't going to let us come visit you. And he said, just fill out the form. See what happens. So we filled it out, and they approved it.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know, maybe New Hampshire's not doing background checks, I don't know. But anyway, so we got approved. So we drive back to Maine, and we stop in Concord, and we go visit John Maynard for 2 hours. And that was a strange thing, but it was also very healing for me. Because, you know, I told you that I really loved him, and it took me 3 years or more to let go. But when I walked through that door and saw him, that was closure, and it was... You know, it was good. And he got to meet Chris, and Chris got to meet him, and Chris likes him. They talked on the phone for quite a lot. Anyway, John made New Hampshire mad, and they sent him back to Kansas, and he was in Kansas for a while, and now I hear he's in Arizona, but we don't talk now. I don't really know why, but about a year and a half ago, we were opening a new office for my business, and we were painting it, and we were on ladders, and John called me a couple times, and I didn't answer my phone because I was up on a ladder, and that was it. So, you know, he got mad. I'm guessing, I'm surmising. He got mad because I didn't answer his call, and so he's done. But that's okay with me because I moved on. So, what was the other question?
Is there anything that we could do?
Help the women. So, yeah, when I went to the jail, the county jail in Leavenworth, they didn't have any books. And they had one cart that was half full of books. So I started this campaign I wrote to all my family and friends, and I told them to send books to the Leavenworth County Jail. And so then after a couple months, the administrator came in to me and said, Toby, we don't have room for any more books, so stop your book campaign. But it's just the little things like that. There's always a need for books or Bibles or study books, or even if you could provide some kind of books to teach women how to write and read. You know, any kind of educational things would just really help them a lot. Writing to them is one thing, but, you know, honestly, there's a lot of con people in prison, I wouldn't open yourself to that unless you're smart enough and versed enough to not get drug into a bunch of drama. But if you could just contact the local jails and ask what they could use, you know, they might need books, or they might need paper. If you could donate some paper so that women didn't have to buy paper off the commissary to write letters to their loved ones, that would be a big help. Just anything. Stamps. If you donated stamps and the jail would let them have them for free, then, you know, just anything like that that helps them feel like they're real people. Or you could donate soap or anything like that. So, anything else?
Thank you so much.
I know I took up a lot of time.
No.